Welcome to Season 5, Episode 17 of Beyond the Zero. I'm your host, Ben. Joining me today is Nathan Knapp. Nathan is a writer, and his debut novel, Daybook, is out now from Splice. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thank you, Ben.
You're joining me from the home of country music, as far as I know, because that's about all I know about Nashville, but tell us about life over there.
Life here is okay, generally speaking. Yeah. It's very hot today.
Nashville's a fairly big city, I imagine, right?
Yeah. You might call it a small, big city. It feels bigger than it actually is. I think maybe because the various cultural things going on in it, but yeah, it feels like a larger city than it is. But the park that I live in is quite quiet.
Okay. I want you to tell me a bit about growing up in Oklahoma, because we were talking about it before we started recording, and growing up in a really small town over there. And then just give us a bit of your background in terms of, where you went to college and things like that.
Yeah, so I grew up in a very, very small town in northern McCurtain County, Oklahoma, right at around 100 people, which it's a town that actually feels kind of smaller than that.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, although a lot more people live in the woods, but it's culturally a lot more like, I don't know, maybe more like the South than the rest of Oklahoma, and also looks different than what most people who haven't been there would imagine it being. Like, really, it's kind of like the far end of the Ozarks, so
Okay.
It's kind of in little mountains, but very remote. I don't think there was a paved road going into and out of the town until the 60s, so geographically quite remote, although changing very fast with tourism and stuff. But growing up there, it was very isolated.
Yeah.
Very isolated.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about that because I think it plays into your book nicely. But in terms of that, so after Oklahoma, I know you went to university and college in Seattle, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to get as far away as I could. In the U.S., I think that's almost as far as you can. I'm staying in the continental U.S. I just wanted to be somewhere with people, somewhere. And yeah, so I went to college out there in Seattle, and then I've shuffled back and forth from Oklahoma to Seattle a few times, and now Nashville.
I want to ask you briefly about Seattle because it's one of those cities that I've never been to, but of kind of always wanted to go to. But how is it like living over there?
It's interesting. It's changed a lot, from being like a sort of dirty, sort of grungy town to being very, being very professional, being very corporate. I mean, a lot of that's come from Amazon being headquartered out there. I found it over time just to be so culturally different from what I was raised with, that it kind of irritates the hell out of me, as a place. But on a sunny day, it's as beautiful as anywhere in the world, I think. Unfortunately, 90% of the year, that's not quite true.
I think it's about 300 days a year. I think that's what
80% of the year, you can't see the mountains, you can't see anything but these low hanging clouds that are just there, and it doesn't really even rain. So, it spits today, but you don't really get the release of actual rain. You just have clouds. And I found that I like to be hot and I like to sweat, and I like it when people don't look at me like a crazy person when I speak to them and I don't know them. Like in Seattle, if you talk to somebody on the bus, their first thought is that person okay? Speaking of that. I don't know.
I want to ask you about your background as a writer. This is your first novel, and it is written in a way that I don't see many first novels because the writing is so crisp. You're so assured in the way you've done this. I want to just talk about, or I want you to talk about becoming a writer and some of the other stuff you've done previous to this.
Well, thank you. It's definitely not the first manuscript that I've written. It's definitely the first to be published, but I've wanted to do two things in my life, and the first was to be a professional baseball player. And after I realized that wasn't going to happen, I wanted to be a writer. So it's been pretty much all I've ever wanted to do. Everything, so I was probably 13 or 14. But this is probably the fourth or fifth full manuscript that I've written. So,
Wow.
yeah. And at this point, I mean, although that was very frustrating, not being able to sell the first few, I'm really glad that this is the one. I don't think as you get older, you regret not having been able to say all the stupid things that you did and things you wrote in your 20s. For instance, I'm quite happy that most of that stuff's not in the public.
So with this book, before we talk about the book itself, do you want to just tell us about the process of writing this book and when did you actually complete this manuscript?
So the process of writing it or beginning to write it was interesting because it wasn't like something that I'd been thinking of. It was just that I got a particular sentence stuck in my head and went home and wrote it down that same night, which is I think the first sentence of the book. And I went home and I wrote it down and kept writing and immediately knew that there was a book in it that like was going to come out of that thing. That felt like it was going to be something immediately because of the way that I wrote the first three, four pages, maybe seven, eight pages over the course of a few days. And they had this sort of interlocking or braided structure where paragraphs would refer back to each other. Somehow that way of writing it solved some problems for me in that like I don't know how long a paragraph's supposed to be, you know. I mean, English teachers will tell you how long a paragraph should be, but like I've never really known, like, is it supposed to be long, is it supposed to be short, like how long is it supposed to be? And I found that I couldn't start a new one until I'd referred to something I'd already written in the text, and that like solved the problem of a paragraph. And then I just knew there wouldn't be any breaks in it either, because the book doesn't have any chapter breaks or even any section breaks, you know. It begins a new paragraph, and that was in it from the very start, and was kind of how I knew that it was a book even after the first handful of pages, because it seemed to want to be more in my head, you know, even though I hadn't planned on writing it. Didn't even really know what it was about to start with. But that's kind of how it started to come out. Yeah. I started writing the book in November 2020. And then I finished the first draft on the same day, November 21. And honestly, after the first 3 months of writing it, after the first 60 pages were written, I got so embarrassed about the content that I had to put it away. And I couldn't imagine anybody reading it. And so I put it away and then came back and did end up finishing the first draft, but I've been working on it off and on for 3 years, maybe a little bit more. There are things that are in the finished copy of the book now that were written maybe back in the summer, last summer, like or maybe more recently. You know, so into 2023. So I have a, it says at the end, you know, that it was from 2020 to 2021, but that was just the first draft. In terms of like when are you done writing is really hard because, you know, you have all these rounds of
Editing and
edits and revisions, you know. The last thing I changed was probably right before the book went to press.
Wow. All right. I want to move on to the book itself. It's out from one of my favorite presses, Splice. It takes the form of almost this journal, I suppose, by a man who's visiting his childhood home and explores his struggles with religion, death, family, faithfulness. the idea of legacy as well, and a whole lot of other themes that you go into. I'm assuming that the book is fairly autobiographical. Do you want to just tell us about the setup of the book and some of your inspiration for writing the book?
I mean, it is sort of unavoidably autobiographical. It's kind of funny. In conversations with my editor Dan, Daniel Davis Wood, who has been an amazing editor, it's the best editorial experience I've ever had. It's kind of funny. In him going over the manuscript and talking about it with me, he always refers to the narrator of the book, and so whenever I'm talking with Dan, I just sort of defer to him, and I also refer to the narrator of the book. But there's not a whole hell of a lot of invented material. So yeah, in terms of inspirations for the book, the main one, which I don't think really has any kind of, there's no influence or thing that you would see that is like it in the book, is a book called Diary by the Polish writer Witold Gombrowicz. And he wrote that book. Of course, his is like 1,000 pages long, but it's called Diary, but he wrote it in public consumption. He didn't write it as a the sort of everyday mundane details, that's in your notebook kind of diary, but it was meant for and that was probably the major touchstone, or the kind of thing underneath the work. That and another writer named E.M. Chowron, thinking about like his ideas about shame specifically. And then also definitely read a little bit of Gerald Murnane before getting going. I like the way that Murnane doesn't use very many commas. It's maybe a weird thing to say about him, but I love how his English sentence, kind of like Faulkner's English sentence, like it doesn't depend on punctuation, but the actual, the language itself is so elegant and so wonderfully done. Those are a couple of different things. And then also John Berryman's The Dream Songs. He's a poet. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but like just the way that he talks about dreams and grief and his childhood, I think is a major touchstone for me. And that's probably the earliest book I've been reading that off and on for, I don't know, probably 15 years at this point.
In terms of this book, it's basically this journal that your narrator is writing. Do you want to tell us about where we start and what we're doing in Oklahoma when we start this book?
Yeah, so I went to the narrator's childhood home. This is a way to solve this problem. And it began with a statement that I heard the narrator's paternal grandfather say, which was just this statement that his son had made about where he wanted his ashes scattered when he died. And for me, when I begin writing anything, it's because there's like either an image or some little bit of language that gets stuck in my head that sort of seems to insist, like it insists on something, like on being on the page or something like that. And it was during the pandemic, late in the first year, and I spent the afternoon with him hunting, as Southeastern Oklahomans like to do, by driving around in a pickup. Guess we shouldn't tell the game warden that, but and I went home and I wrote down the sentence, and it seemed to have a lot of things in it. Like a lot of different things were just kind of appearing on the page. And I've always wanted to write a book about my life as it's happening, for one thing. But also kind of write a book that doesn't have anything happening in a plot sense, but like has this move around in the narrator's mind. in the writer's mind, and just be a product of that, which is, I think, maybe a bit of the attraction of Gerald Brené, but also the attraction of like taking a book like The Dream Songs as a touchstone. That book is 400 odd poems. They're all kind of the same thing. They're all just moving around in John Berryman's mind, Yeah, so that's kind of how the book came to begin, came to exist.
One of the things I really loved about reading this book is the fact that it feels like you're reading something that's being written live almost, because you get the feeling that this guy is coming home, writing what he's writing, and then, we're getting to read it almost as is. Do you want to tell us about that aspect of the book?
I very much wanted that to be the feeling of it, and I have tried to do that unsuccessfully in the past, but I really wanted to do that. And I talk about this with my friend, but Louis Friedman a lot, but we really like books that sort of, I don't know if dramatize is the right word, their own making. They are continually reminding you of their status as a thing that's being written. It's being put on the page here today. And of course, you go back and you revise it and you try to hide that act of revising, but I also would put that in there, I think, a few times, in revising yesterday's passage, or and looking over these sentences that I've already written. But I love that kind of work. I think in your last podcast with Gary Letts, she talked about like liking mundane, like things that are about the mundane, and that I kind of laughed when I was listening to that. So I was like, I love that kind of thing too. I don't love all of his work, but Carlo Knausgård's first two books of my struggle books. I like how he manages to kind of take that approach to his work. He gets kind of sloppy in some of the other ones, but those first two of that, I don't know if they're all one book or how you want to talk about them, but like in the first two, there's like a real energy and a real heat. Like there's a kind of desperation to get it onto the page and get it out, Whereas maybe in the later works, he's also trying to fulfill the publishing contract that he, signed. But I love reading diaries. I love reading letters, almost as much as I like reading authors themselves, There's a wonderful, I think his name is Carl Rawlinson, a biographer. He wrote a big biography of Faulkner, and I think it Sylvia Plath. But one of the my favorite things that I read last year was just a book called Faulkner Day by Day. And it was just whatever he was up to that particular day, every day of his life, that they have some sort of, record of it. And I can't really imagine why most people would want to read it, but I'm delighted to know, like Faulkner took his airplane up today. He had a big fight with his wife the next day. The next day, just like those kinds of things. And I like that kind of work. Because my own life is not like exciting, I like knowing that writers that I think of as being like truly incredible artists are also, they get up in the morning, they take a shit, they go to work, they do their things, I like reading about that kind of stuff.
It plays out really well in this book. And I think, like you said, with the idea of recalling stuff at the beginning of paragraphs from earlier sections, I think this book does really reward the reader as well, because some of the callbacks and some of the slow way you've kind of reveal information throughout the book, I think, is really interesting. Because I think there's one thing that I think I remember reading on the weekend where you basically call back right to the beginning of the book, like almost at the end of the book. And it's done in such a way where you're just like, oh, like now I'm putting like this all together and it like all makes sense. And the way you've done it just kind of builds and builds like till we get to the end.
I always feel like it feels good when writers do that. When you get lines that come back, the reward of kind of paying attention, you're like, oh yeah, that was referred to earlier, it's curious because that was something that I wanted to do in the book, but was also integral to the architecture of the book,
Mm.
you know, because sometimes as I was sitting there, I wouldn't know what to write next because I was writing, you know, just every day and often just putting in things that I noticed while I was writing, you know, or things that had happened to me earlier in the day. But then, you know, I would feel like I was getting towards the end of the paragraph, and then a line from earlier in the text would come, sort of pop in my head that goes here. And then sometimes that would create very jarring juxtapositions, you know, because they would maybe have hardly anything to do with what I was writing about, but it felt like it worked, you know. So it also is something that caused seemingly disparate things to, you know, be juxtaposed and maybe acquire a kind of frisson, I don't know, maybe hope, perhaps.
I like how the book has this almost circular structure because you started at this family home in Oklahoma and you end there as well. In terms of that stuff, like for me as a reader, I think that works so beautifully because you start, like, I think you went mentioned towards the end that basically this is a year since I started this book at the same place. Do you want to just tell us about that idea of having this almost circular structure?
I really wanted to go back and have the book end right where it started. I don't remember exactly when I figured out that that was how it would end, but there was some point during that year where I was like, in order to finish, I need to go back and I need to write the last bit there. And it needs to end there. I don't know if there was like any that just felt like it would be satisfying to me. I hope that it works. There's another Norwegian writer named Thomas Espedal, who has written a number of kind of autofictional books. He's a much more impressionistic writer, and less voluble, or I don't think voluble is the right word, less prolix than Knausgård. But he often will write a book and he'll set it over the course of a year. And so if you know, have read his last five books, you've read about five different years in Espedal's life. And I don't know, it's just nice to see, satisfying to me as a reader to see a person, you know, and also remain over the course of that kind of calendar. And it's also very handy as a writer because then you have a nice little ending spot for your book. You know, in a more made up novel, you can kill the main character, you know, or you can have the marriage end or reassume or whatever. And when you write more autobiographically, you know, the calendar year, there you go. Now you have a spot in the book. Just pragmatically speaking, that is a handy feature, you know. I was talking about, I've been reading The Road by Cormac McCarthy with my students, and we were talking about why at the very end the boy finds a man comes up to the boy after his father's died, and we're all like, does this work, you know, and it's like, well, the book has to end somewhere, you know, father's in, yeah, the father dies, there we go, Cormac can end the book. Whereas if they hadn't got lucky all those other times, then he would have had to end the book on page like 30, you know. So
That's it. I feel like this book is rooted in the American South, and in fact, on the copy that I've got here, it describes you as the Murnane of the American South, which I find really funny because as Murnane, he's probably, I guess, the Australian Faulkner. Do you want to tell us about this world of the American South, like this setting you've got us in? Because we do have these bookends that are set in Oklahoma, back in, the Oklahoma of your youth.
it's a strange place. Maybe a stupid thing to say, but growing up in Oklahoma, I didn't really think of it as part of the South. I thought it was something separate and distinct. And in some ways, it is. It's not a part of the original, I guess, Confederacy or whatever, because it wasn't a state, you know, at that time. But the thing about the South that's interesting, or one of the things, is you have all this both living and buried history, you know. The neighborhood where I live, my apartment building, is a part of where the Battle of Nashville took place, which was a pivotal battle in the Civil War. I live on the battlefield, and it's not really memorialized in any meaningful way here in Nashville because it was a Confederate loss. So there wasn't a whole lot of urge, by native Nashvillians to like mark off the place and be like, let's remember this. But it's a huge thing that happened right here. We just drive around I sit on my patio, and it's curious that that's, a part of history that's like right here. Or like where I was just living in Tulsa, and it was the scene of worst racial massacres in American history. And until the last decade or two, there was no memory of that culturally. I grew up without knowing anything about that. So it's curious to me that we live in this landscape that is imbued with all these things. But at the same time, there's not really, or often not, there's no way in which the culture has tried to remember it. There is an old plantation half an hour from where I live that has been turned into this really fancy sort of McMansion development with these huge, enormous houses and a golf course going down the middle of it. And the golf course is lined with old slave quarters. And people just get out and play golf there. It's an absurd and strange place. And I think that in some ways, I find it hard to ignore that. And it's interesting to write about and think about in terms of how landscape or land remembers what has happened in it and on it. And also to elaborate a bit further about Oklahoma and the landscape that I'm in there, like that is so a part of my childhood that going back there, I feel like I'm going back to like a part of myself whenever I'm there. And I think that one book began there, and I wanted it to end there. Like that specific spot, that house, that river, those woods, I feel really more like myself when I'm there.
Interesting. One of the things that I think maybe links you to Monane, apart from landscape stuff, is the idea of, I guess, faith or religion, things like that coming into writing. I want to just ask about, I guess, that aspect of the work in terms of, your focus on things like faith.
Sure, in terms of writing about it, or in
Yeah.
terms of
Well, how does it play out, like in terms of writing, but also in terms of the like this landscape of Oklahoma where it seems like people are not God obsessed, but like there's a definite focus on that.
no, sort of like landscape, it's something that if you grow up it. It's like landscape if you grow up in the middle of nowhere, a place where it's much more of a feature than other people in some ways. The community that I grew up in, specifically the part of the community that I grew up in, was very religious. I went to church 3 times a week as a kid, play around age 1 to age 18. I could only get out of it if I was sick. I think that I lost my faith in my early 20s, and in part, I don't think you really lose the structure of that belief if you've really grown up with it and it's been like a major part of your world. You can say you don't believe in it anymore, but it's almost, I kind of feel haunted by it in a way, by both the sort of failed promises of that faith, like eternal life, goodness, meaning. If you lose your faith, what do you have after that? You've got, like I said, this is the book, you've got nothingness after death and meaninglessness. It's really great trade. It doesn't feel like a great trade to me. And that loss, I think, is important to me. I don't think I know it is. I wish it wasn't what I keep writing about. But it is. It's everything that I end up writing somehow goes back to that sort of loss of being. I don't feel like it's a very contemporary issue, at least for many people. So it's a little bit to me, but I don't know how to write about anything else. There's also a sense like here in Nashville is a very like evangelical town. There's almost an assumption when you meet somebody new that you're a believer, you go to church and all that. And that is it's very strange to live here and have that be like the assumption automatically. You're straight, you're a believer, you do all these things. That's the assumption. And to live here and not meet all those assumptions can kind of make you feel like you're a tad invisible or something. That's a strange feeling.
Interesting. All right. I want to talk about Splice because Daniel Davis Wood, I think he does some great work. And for this year, Suavity of the Rock by Greg Gierke and your book are the only two books they're putting out. Both look amazing. The cover on both books are just incredible. They work beautifully together. I want to ask you about working with Splice and Daniel Davis Wood editing this great novel.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Dan is a fantastic editor. I'm so happy about it. Like it's hard to know like where to start, but like his eye and his vision for working on the book. I mean, compared to maybe like being with a mainstream publisher or a big five publisher, I for a while had a I had a literary agent. In the way that that my agent would want to edit things was generally to making them more clear, looking at the more, I don't know, traditional in sort of emphasizing the more traditional features of Anglo-American realism, characters having plots, motivations, we understand why people are doing things, coherence, things like that. And Dan, doesn't really seem to care about those things at all. He just wanted to make it the best book that it could possibly be, And there were sections where maybe I hadn't quite expressed myself as well as I could. And he was always editing with a mind to making the novel the best novel it could be, not in any way a more approachable novel or a more sellable novel or a more understandable novel. He just wanted to make it the best thing, which is what I wanted. And so it's an incredible pleasure to work with him on the book. And the cover does look really nice. I'm really happy about it.
Yeah, it's
And in good company too. Like that was another thing that was nice at an indie press like this that was published. Publishing Greg's books coming out this year, but also Mark De Silva's book, The Logos,
yeah.
last year, was real. Gabriel Blackwell. I liked the other writers in the press a great deal, so it felt
Yeah.
like an honor to be included.
Definitely. Finally, on this book, I want to ask you about the title. I believe that daybook and diary are very similar words, like in terms of the etymology, but do you want to tell us about the title?
I was thinking of trying to find a word like diary or something like that. But for the longest time, I didn't know what to call it. It was just called the date that I started writing it for probably the first 8 months that I was working on it. It was just I just referred to it by the date. But then there's so much in the book about sex and some of like about sex work and also like paying for these things. And a daybook is slightly different than a diary in that a daybook is usually a ledger, right? It's a kind of ledger. You include numbers and things like that in it. And also there's also a sense in terms of writing about sexuality and sex that I was trying to write about things that up to now or up to a big beginning writing that were very much things that I had not discussed or that people don't normally discuss the nighttime topics, you know? And so I wanted to call it that because part of what I was wanted to do was like actually bring all these things about sexuality that I have never really interrogated or talked about into the light, I guess, you know? So, but also to have that sort of uncomfortable notion of a ledger at the same time. And also the book does kind of mark the days too. So, for lack of a better explanation, that's what I've got.
Perfect. So now that this book is out here in the world and you're, it's basically it's launched, it's, going to be in the hands of lots of people very soon. Are you writing something new? Do you go straight to a new book?
I've been working on another book at the same time, actually, that I began a little bit before the book. Initially, kind of as a joke, a way to entertain myself. But I've been to distinguish it from daybook, I would say it's made up. I mean, I call daybook a novel when I think about it as a novel, mostly because I think of myself as a novelist, I guess. This is a very made up book, but it began as a series of short stories about somebody named Schopenhauer, who sort of dimly resembles the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. But I realized while I was writing about it that I could put him in a place that I wanted. I could put him in his native Germany in the 19th century, or I could put him in my apartment, or I could put him in, I don't know, ancient Palestine or wherever I wanted to. And then I could also kill him off as many times as I wanted to, and stories could just repeat. I have thought of it as a book of stories. I have a friend who's read it who says it's a novel. I'm not really sure what it is. It's just this strange fiction, where you see Schopenhauer, who's a sort of, I don't know, proto-Bernhardian complainer type person. But it's just a ridiculous, strange book. Jesus has a recurring role in the book. Every he's sort of a bad roommate type character. There's
Leaving blood everywhere from the stigmata.
usually like he shows up and he wants $20 or something. But like I was writing the stories and I realized early on that they had a constraint too, which is that every story had to have a policeman, some sort of weird and uncomfortable sexual interaction. Somebody had to die in some horribly gratuitous way. And then almost all of the stories have the same quotation that's actually from Schopenhauer, which is that all of our suffering spring from having to do with other people. And so all of those things occur in every chapter. And it's been a real pleasure to do After Day books, just very somber, you know, it's just sort of relentless somberness. And so I'm writing something profoundly ridiculous. So yeah.
Okay, I'd love to
Hopefully,
see that.
hopefully.
All right. I want to move on to your gateway books. What were some of the books that inspired you as a reader and writer?
Like a lot of kids, The Lord of the Rings was one of the first things, you know, it was like, oh, you can have an entire world. That was very early, but as far as more serious books, the most important was probably reading Dostoevsky as a teenager. Reading Notes from Underground and being like, what the hell is this? You know, this is crazy. Reading that, reading Kierkegaard was important, just his book Fear and Trembling, in terms of it shaping the kind of person of faith that I was at the time, which is something that I think I'm sort of unpacking a little bit in Daybook. And then Annie Dillard was a big one for me early on. I loved her work. Those were probably the first few big
Okay.
important ones.
Interesting. Okay. Moving on, can you tell us about some of the books you're currently reading or you've recently enjoyed or you're looking forward to?
Sure. Right now I'm slogging my way through a book by Michel Layrus. I'm not sure if I'm saying his name correctly. Layrus. called The Ribbon at Olympia's Throat, and I'm reading that because I want to read another book called Songs. I think it's called Songs of Olympia.
Songs for Olympia, yeah.
Songs for Olympia by Tomoe. That's how you say her name, Tomoe Hill.
Yeah.
And it's weird because it's such a pleasure in spots to Laris, but sometimes I have no idea what he's talking about
Yeah.
for long stretches. And then I'll hit another stretch that's like exactly what I want. It's taken me a very long time to get through it. So eventually I'm going to get to Tomoe Hill's book, hopefully. I just finished reading most of Cormac McCarthy's Tennessee books, his early career books, which have been an immense pleasure. That and I have been off and on for the past couple of years reading a lot about the Civil War, which is probably not terribly interesting to most of your audience, but just reading lots of stuff about that. One day, a plan to maybe in like 20 years write this big historical novel that will hopefully make me lots of money. Hopefully, when I no longer need it, but it probably won't happen until then. So,
Sounds good.
probably shouldn't say that, but that's my 20-year plan.
Are there books coming up during the year that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to Greg's book In the Suavity of the Rock, my press mate.
Yeah.
Also, Mauro Javier Cardenas's book,
American Abductions, yeah.
American Abductions. I loved aphasia, so I'm excited. He does incredible things with the sentence. His long, unending sentences that are really wonderful. And then Adam Erlich Sachs's book, which is, I think, called Gretel and the Great War. I think
Yeah, I
that's the
think
name of
that's
that.
right. Yeah.
I very much enjoyed his most recent novel. And then I just recently got a copy of Gabriel Blackwell's new book. His title I'm unfortunately forgetting. But it's like a limited release book. So I'm excited. I'm excited for those the most. And then this is not new, but I'm planning on making another attempt at Blood Meridian, which I've never managed to make it through, but that's on the warm weather list.
Yeah. I struggled with that book the first two times I tried to read it, and then the last time I got through it, but it's not the most pleasant experience of,
I started it a few months ago and I got too excited. I had too much going on and I was like, this is going to take over my life if I read this right now.
Yeah.
So I set it aside. So my wife's currently borrowing the copy. So
Okay.
see.
Nice. One other writer I just wanted to bring up with you, and I'm going to butcher his name like I usually do, but in your little book, day book, you quote right at the beginning, "A writer's source is his shames," and it's Emil Cioran, but obviously that's not how you pronounce his name because I don't know how you pronounce it.
I think it's pronounced Chowron. I have no idea
Chowron.
why, but I that's the yeah, I
Yeah.
think that's
Because he comes up quite a bit in day book as well, but do you want to tell us about reading him?
I love him. I read Chowron when I'm feeling bad, which is funny because he's like one of the most pessimistic people writers I think ever.
Yeah.
He's always saying how miserable the world is, kind of like Schopenhauer. He mostly wrote aphorisms, like these little collections of aphorisms. And then he also wrote longer essays. But he's somebody that I turn to again and again. I reread his work every year. It speaks to some screwed up part of my brain. He's also incredibly funny, an incredibly funny writer, which doesn't really come across in a statement like a writer's sources are his shames, but I keep coming back to him and plan to keep doing so just because it feeds something in me, I like writers who like Thomas Bernhard also who get so bleak that they actually sort of come out, they fall out the other side of bleak laughing, it's like they just make things as dark as possible and it ends up starting to like illuminate something,
Yeah.
and Chowron does that in spades. So I think the last book that I had checked out from the Tulsa Public Library before we moved was a book of his called Anathemas and Admirations, which I had made so many notes in that I ended up just taking with me to Nashville and not returning. I think I paid $80 for it. I was like, screw it. This is mine now. I guess we should probably shouldn't tell the Tulsa Public Library that, but who cares?
They won't mind.
We'll take a quick break here. I'm Ian Lazaro. We're speaking with Nathan Knapp. This week's episode is sponsored by the Chicago Tourism Board. Are you sick of New York and LA? Does Boston give you the shits? Is Hawaii too far away? Well, why not visit one of America's most progressive and cultural cities? Chicago has great bars, great nightlife, great arts, and we have the Bean. Oh, for fuck's sake, do I really have to read that? Who the fuck gives a shit about the fucking Bean?
Just read the fucking ad, asshole.
How'd you get into my house? Visit Chicago, it's really good. Take a selfie with the Bean. There is no Bean Mafia. We're back on Beyond the Zero. It's time for Nathan's Desert Island Books.
The Dream Songs by John Berryman, mentioned already. Lombrovich's Diary is one. That book by Chao Ron that I just described stealing from the public library is probably would be one. I affection for that particular copy, just I've put it through so much. Gathering Evidence by Thomas Bernhard, his memoir, doesn't get talked about enough. I feel like it's richest work in films. A book called Norwood by Charles Portis, one of the funniest American novels ever, I think. A book called God's Country by Percival Everett. Everett's getting talked a lot right now because the movie American Fiction, but God's Country is this sort of early Western period. It's just wonderful. It's one of the best Westerns, I think. And then I guess some less exciting choices, like The Sound and the Fury of Faulkner is when I reread Ulysses. And then another book that I find myself rereading almost every year is a book called The Moviegoer by Walker Percy. I'd have to take that one in with me. I've reread that one so many times that I'm borrowing other people's copies so that I can get outside of my own underlining.
I have to read that. That's been on my list of things to read for years and years and years, but I've never got around to it.
It's a wonderful little book. It's marred by the sort of soft-pedaled Southern racism of its time. But outside of that, it's really funny book, and also feel kind of akin to, and it's sort of, it has this search for meaning amidst meaninglessness in it. Very funny. So I'd recommend it. It may also be one of those books that may be best read at like age 21 or 22. Also, that may be the time when you have to read it to get really taken with it. But I would still recommend it. Yeah.
All right. I should wrap it up with you. Congratulations on Daybook. It is one of the best things I've read this year. It is just stunning work. Before I let you go, do you want to tell us where we can grab Daybook and where we can get in touch with you online?
I would highly recommend buying it from Splice on their website. Buying it from the publisher that helps both the press and me more. And say buying it from Amazon, and with the sort of collapse of SPD, and from the publisher, even more meaningful these days. So that's how I'd recommend. It's also available, I think, everywhere else, like on Bookshop and on Amazon, I guess. But yeah, I'm on Twitter at Nate_Knapp24. That's probably the best place to find me. Although I can't recommend the tweets themselves.
One of the things I also saw is you're doing an event for the launch of this book with Greg Gerke. Do you want to tell us when that is and where we can go and see it?
Yeah, so it's going to be on May 17th, I believe around 7 o'clock, I think. Don't quote me on the time, but it'll be on May 17th at Unnameable in Brooklyn. And I'll be discussing Greg's book and The Suavity of the Rock with him. I'm discussing mine with me. It should be fun.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And I highly recommend the book. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Thanks once again to Nathan Knapp. Check out the show notes for all the details. You can get his book from Splice. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with your next episode very soon.